Welcome to the Digital Migration Podcast, an initiative of the Line of Research on Migration and Digital Transformation of Nova Refugee Legal Clinic. Our group is composed by
Priscila Azevedo,
Fiesa Lyman,
Victoria Costa, Inês Freire dos Santos, and me, Emeline de Oliveira. And I have today the honor of sharing this episode with three distinguished guests. Professor Alexander McKenzie, lecturer in international politics at the University of Liverpool. Professor Ricardo Rodrigues de Oliveira, guest assistant professor at the Portuguese Catholic University School of Law. And Dr. Mirko Forti, research fellow at Santana School of Advanced Studies. Thank you all for having accepted our invitation and be here today with us. So I would like to start with a question to you, Professor Alexander. Since 2001, with the terrorist attacks on the Twin Towers in the USA, it has been started the war on terror. Has this war had any influence on internal security cooperation in the European Union?
Absolutely huge. And well, I should have started with thank you for having me. It's very nice to be here and very nice to discuss these things. Always enjoy doing so. So yeah, moving on to the answer to your question. Yes, it's had a massive impact. I mean, people have even referred to it in the literature as there being a kind of month of transformation after 9/11, that it's fundamentally changed the governance of the EU. So, you know, massive changes came around after 9/11. I think we've also got to compare this to what was occurring in the 1990s. Though. In the 1990s, the EU was almost kind of no play, had pretty much no role in countering terrorism. There was some discussions at places like Tampere, of course, in the 1990s, but nothing serious was going to happen. It took 9/11 for something serious to happen, and all of a sudden there was this sudden burst of activity. I'd say, if we look back now, 20 years later, we can see that there were kind of two, I think, big periods of activity since then. We've had the period after 9/11, and of course we've had the different attacks that occurred thereafter, of course on Madrid and London, up to about kind of 2006, 2007. And then we had another burst of activity, I think, with the emergence of Islamic State, starting from somewhere around about 2013, 2014 onwards, to give, of course, examples of the specific measures that followed in those periods. I'd say we can think about the European arrest warrant that was seen as such a big move after 9/11. And then we have, of course, measures that we're going to talk about further today, like the EU PNR measure that emerged in the period around about Islamic States and the issue of foreign fighters. I'll just finish before we move on to the next question to say about who's kind of driven this. And I think the most important actors have been, and of course we've talked about, and this is interesting in relation to the different literature, is the role of the EU institutions themselves, such as the European Commission, of course, but also the US, which pressured the EU an awful lot, especially in the kind of earlier period where you had the original EU-US PNR agreement, the Container Security Initiative, these sorts of things. But also, I think what's been underrepresented in the literature is the role of specific member states. I think the UK in particular was really, really, really important, and especially its presidency in about second half of 2005. And some of these measures that I'm talking about, I think, starts in the UK, and the UK attempts to push these further. And this is something I'm interested in kind of developing my own work in due course. But I will stop there and allow other people, of course, to have their turn.
Thank you very much. It was a wonderful beginning. Thank you. So my next question goes to Professor Ricardo. In 2016, the EU Parliament and the Council adopted the directive on the use of passenger name record, the PNR data, for the prevention, detection, investigation and prosecution of terrorist offence and serious crime. Please, could you explain to our audience what the so-called EU PNR directive consists of?
Good morning all again, and thank you so much for this invitation and for such an interesting event. Let me begin with a sort of a brief setting of the scene. You know, after 9/11, as Professor McKenzie said, following the second burst of terrorist activity in Europe, I think, and I argue that in my thesis, the European Union lived under a sort of climate of fear in 2015, 2016. And a series of terrorist attacks within its borders led it to raise its security levels to what we believe to be an unprecedented degree. And so What happened was that the EU and national legislators then set out to adjust their security agendas, beginning with the UK, but then over the continent to better prevent, indeed, to better prevent, detect, investigate, and eventually prosecute terrorism and serious crime. And this led to the approval of wide-scope surveillance mechanisms that basically rely on the collection, retention, and processing of big data. And much of that data is of a personal nature, like biometric, financial, travel information. All of such data are nowadays gathered to monitor EU citizens and third country nationals in a sort of systematic and systemic way, both by public entities and private actors. And so what happens is that the PNR directive, the Passenger Name Records Directive, is part and parcel of this security-driven package. PNR refers to electronic receipts generated and mostly managed by transportation companies, in this case by air companies, by air carriers, and which contain more or less up to 19 elements of personal data of what we call prospective future air passengers. Basically all the data that we upload to booking and reservation systems, like the websites of air companies or platforms like Amadeus, whenever we want to fly. And the thing is, with this directive, with the PNR directive, these data, which were once used exclusively by carriers for marketing and other private, mostly commercial purposes, must now be transferred to passenger information units. These units, also called PIUs, are basically law enforcement, or should be law enforcement authorities, designated to process that data and to look for and try and find what we can call meaningful patterns, meaningful connections to eventually fight terrorism and other serious crime. In other words, the directive instructs member states to take the data that are already collected by air carriers when they create a user or passenger profile. And it is true that it does not impose any new obligation on carriers from this end, and then tells member states to scan that data for a whole different purpose, to prevent, detect, investigate, and prosecute such crimes. And while the directive is thought to apply to extra EU flights or aims to apply to extra EU flights, it also opens the door, and this has been approved by all member states across the board, it also opens the door to intra-EU flights. And it serves, I think, and I argue, and I'll finish here, it serves as a next level in profiling and scanning through data. It serves to know what was previously unknown with existing database security tools, like advanced passenger information, system and all the biometric data that are contained in passports. So PNR serves to find loopholes. And this was basically the arguments used in favor of such a directive in the EU Parliament, to find loopholes, to track loose hands, to put together a more detailed picture of everyone, of every passenger. And in the end, what these PIUs, these passenger information units, can do also is that to transfer the data. So it doesn't end here. It transfers the data or the results of their processing to other authorities, to other agencies, from the police to secret services, for eventually further action and to monitor this even further.
Thank you for this excellent explanation. Thank you. So my next question is for Dr. Mirko. The recital 7 of the EU PNR directive explains that by using PNR data, it's possible to address the threat of terrorist offenses and serious crime from a different perspective than through the processing of other categories of personal data. Concerning data retention, what are the limits of the use of PNR data, and what would be possible exceptions?
Thank you for your question. First of all, I would like to say thank you for your kind invitation. Thank you for having me here at your podcast. As Professor Rodriguez de Oliveira was saying just before, first of all, we need to clarify what PNR data are. PNR data could include information about the passenger, so name, contact details, contact information, means of payment, number of the seat, travel agency, and so on and so forth. Information about the flight, so flight itinerary, flight dates, and so on and so forth. all this data, all this information are collected, are elaborated in order to accomplish the goals of the directive. Goals, as you were just mentioning, goals fighting against terrorism, fighting against international terrorism, fighting against the transnational crime episodes. Well, about limits and exception of the directive, the directive clearly states that data are collected and retained for a period of 5 years, and only after an initial period of 6 months, such data are anonymized. In addition to that, the directive prohibits the collection and elaboration of the so-called sensitive data. Sensitive data, information revealing additional details, additional information about sensitive features. Sensitive features, race, ethnicity, cultural background, political orientation, religious, philosophical beliefs, and so on and so forth. However, in spite of these norms, in spite of this provision, it is still possible to know such information. How? Matching PNR data against other relevant databases, like the Schengen Information System. Such matching mechanism allows the creation of an overall picture, of an overall profile of involved passengers. So allows the acknowledgement, allows the recognition of sensitive features. I would like also to remind how EU data protection principles could apply to data processing activities carried out within the PNR directive. Principles like necessity, proportionality, legitimacy, purpose limitation, data minimization. In addition to that, according to the highest fundamental rights protection standards, an interference with the fundamental rights framework should be provided by law. In addition to that, should be labeled as necessary, should be labeled as proportionate to serve any legitimate aim in a democratic society. It is certainly questionable if the PNR directive, if the EU PNR directive really is really compliant with such IGA standards, with such protection standards. Why? According to the EU Commission, about the 81% of the positive hits, what is an hit? An hit is when the algorithm processing PNR data, also against other relevant databases, individuate any potential threat to internal security. Almost 81% of such a hit is successfully discarded as pointless, as useless, as not worthy of further investigation by law enforcement agencies. So a so high percentage of hits successfully discarded is hardly to define compliant with the principle of necessity, of principle of proportionality.
Thank you very much for your answer. And actually, I would like, if you don't mind, just to add a comment. For example, Professor Ricardo was mentioning Amadeus and all the programs that he used to make reservations. And actually, when you want to add information regarding the passenger, I mean, important information, for example, the kind of food or the type of food that the person wants or maybe have any allergen on it, you just add on remarks. And actually remarks, the RM, it's one of the information that airline companies have to provide for the system, for the government. But I'm sure that Professor Ricardo also have something to say on it.
Just two brief comments. Regarding two types of data, for one, you know, when you add information that it makes the service that's provided by air carriers more customized, a better service, for instance, regarding food, sometimes what you eat reveals your religious affiliation, reveals your sensitivities, reveals also health concerns that you may have, and things that the PNR directive, unfortunately, does not look at the processing that is undertaken by carriers. It just looks at PIUs and focuses on PIUs, believing that, you know, air carriers are just, you know, they just convey the information like bluntly without looking at it to the best information units, and is completely unrealistic. And the worst is when, you know, the path that data travels, the path is, you know, regulated by different laws, by different rules. You know, there's a set of rules for air carriers to process it, and then for the PIUs to process, and then eventually other law enforcement authorities to process such data. And in the end, these loopholes without that are generated from not having a single uniform regime lead to, you know, leakages of such an importance that not even the EU Parliament has considered. And in the end, information can be known, sensitive information can be known. And the PNR directive is very deficient in trying to oversee these and actually protecting data. And, you know, and one of the critiques that I do to the directive that I mentioned is that, you know, you anonymize data after 6 months, meaning after the time that it's no longer relevant. Like, who cares after 6 months? It's relevant and it's hot during their first 6 months, or it should be better protected. And also, I think the second comment regarding health information, you know, COVID has shown that member states are certainly willing to go through and scan our information, our personal information, no matter what, to find viruses and to find whatever else they want to find or they can find. So coronavirus and the whole pandemic have been an scapegoat in a way to certain, you know, interferences, to certain meddling with our personal information. And it's interesting to see how this will develop, especially with the ruling of the court when it comes on the validity of the PNR directive. But let's see what the future says about the relationship of PNR and health information and health concerns of the member states. I'm sorry for the interference.
Oh, it was a great one. Thank you very much. So actually, my next question is also for Professor Alexander. So it was regarding your article, the article called Still the Absent Friend, the European Union's Global Counterterrorism Role After 20 Years. You mentioned that the emergence of foreign fighters was perceived as a problem for Central and Eastern European, as well, given that citizens of these states had traveled to join Islamic State. In the framework of cooperation between the European Union and third states, how do you see the externalization of EU security policies through agreements for the transfer of data, such as the PNR data of third country nationals?
Sure, no problem at all. I think it's worth just going back to 9/11, actually, and just talking about how initially, and of course, that he was smaller back then before the enlargement of 2004, you had, I think, a group of states who'd experienced terrorism in the past, right? So the UK, Spain, Italy, Germany, and so on. By contrast, of course, those member states in Eastern Europe and Central Europe hadn't anything like the same level of experience, and that to some extent explains, of course, differing threat perceptions. What happens, I think, or what I was told in interviews several times and what I picked up over the years is that all of a sudden, Central and Eastern European countries were becoming more concerned because, of course, foreign fighters can, you know, move between states. We saw that, of course, with Belgium and France and so on. And, of course, they had specific, especially large concerns, given the number of fighters. But also that, you know, other member states could be travelled through. And some people travelled from Eastern European states and Central European states to fight or participate in some way in what was occurring in Islamic State, of course. So I think we have to, you know, see the kind of differences in those two periods of time. But as I said, it was especially the foreign fighters issue was especially affecting France, Belgium, the UK, Germany still. Moving on to the next point about the externalization of EU counterterrorism, I actually point out that it was actually one of the US who moved first. The US actually pushed the EU into this to some extent. They were very coercive, certainly in the period after 9/11, in terms of the PNR agreement, in terms of the container security agreement, and in terms of others such as over SWIFT as well, the terrorism financing and tracking program agreement. The EU today is of course far more involved and became far more involved in counterterrorism around the world. It now has PNR agreements with a number of different states, including of course the UK with the trade and cooperation agreement. It has agreement with Australia. It had an agreement at least with Canada at one point. And of course, there's been this talk of negotiations surrounding agreements with other states, such as I think Mexico. I'm not entirely sure what's really happened with these, to be honest. I just said negotiations were ongoing for years. But also it's run a number of different projects in other states, such as police training in Afghanistan, mine clearing in Iraq and Syria, reconciliation projects. It's done an awful lot and has become a lot more involved in counterterrorism around the world in very different ways, and not always necessarily newsworthy or in the ways that, say, the US has. I think the big question now is, will this continue, especially with what's going on in Ukraine and Russia? Eastern European states have always been very, very concerned about Russia. You know, climate change rising up, the issue of the UK having left. How much of an issue will terrorism continue to be for the EU after this? And I'm probably thinking it's probably going to go down the agenda quite considerably. Maybe right-wing terrorism is on the rise, but I think there are other concerns right now that have definitely overtaken terrorism.
You're right. Thank you. Thank you very much. And come back to the idea of investment that you were talking about. I also have another question to Professor Ricardo. In your PhD thesis, you mentioned that the Data Retention Directive allowed private actors to consider economic factors when setting their security levels, which allows economic considerations to influence the decisions of providers when implementing data protection safeguards. As the PNR directive is also silent on the limits of economic considerations for private actors to invest in data protection safeguards, to what extent could this silence violate the fundamental rights of individuals traveling to the European Union in search of international protection?
Okay, thank you. Just going back a little to Professor McKenzie's question, I'm sorry, again, I'm meddling. But, you know, actually, just to add this, PNR is in growing across the world at a very fast pace. But curiously, in fact, negotiations with third countries have been stalled for many years. The Mexican, you know, the Spanish delegation at the EP said that the Mexican agreement was vital for the EU. And it has been, almost 10 years, I think, stalled. You know, Japan, the negotiations were quite underway and they're happy going on, but silent, and they disappeared. And then Canada, and I think the Canadian example is the worst problem, that it's been invalidated by the court after the EP asked it. And then what then? You know, life goes on. Are those data being transferred still? What happened? What happened in this case? And we don't know. And basically, do we have our information retained by the Canadian authorities if we travel to Canada? For how long? Or not, and it's, well, obviously it happens, but you know, and the problem is that EU law in this case is put aside. But sorry, coming back to your question, the thing is, the Data Retention Directive, you know, 2006/24, allowed private actors to consider economic factors when setting their security levels, because, you know, money obviously is a concern, and the concern of the EU legislator was that you need, you know, economic operators will spend a lot of money sometimes building a security architecture. And the thing is, Article 7 of the Data Retention Directive said that compliance with data security principles with respect to data retained, and I'm quoting now, in accordance with the directive, was without prejudice to the provisions adopted pursuant to Directives 95/46, which was replaced by the GDPR, and Directive 2002/58. End of quote. And the thing is, Articles 4.1 of Directive 2002/58 and 17.1, the second paragraph of the Directive 95/46, stated that all appropriate technical and organizational measures to protect data should observe the state of the art. And of course, the costs of their implementation. And so the silence of the Data Retention Directive made it possible to interpret its Article 7 as a doorway, let's call it, for allowing economic considerations to influence the decisions of providers, obviously, most of them private actors, you know, private entities, with money as one of the key concerns. So taking these economic considerations when implementing data protection safeguards, and, you know, putting aside sometimes some of the principles that Dr. Mirko said, because, you know, between having a higher security level architecture, but then spending a lot of money on it, and then the what they take from it, you know, directly, sometimes it's not that important. Or sometimes for them, you know, money is more important in their whole operation. And the problem is that the PNR directive is silent here as well. It makes the same, I'm sorry to call it, but the same faux pas as the Data Retention Directive. In this case, it's Article 13, number 3, and 21, number 2, render the GDPR applicable to processing undertaken by carriers. And the thing is, Article 25, number 1 of the GDPR says that the controller shall, both at the time of the determination of the means for processing and at the time of the processing itself, and I'm quoting here, implement appropriate technical and organizational measures, taking into account the state of the art on the cost of implementation, end of quote. So these references lure the PNR directive into the same trap as the Data Retention Directive. In fact, the GDPR actually copies Directive 9546 and 2002-58. And in both cases, what I argue is that references to other legislation make the Data Retention Directive and the PNR directive unable to ensure that private actors employ, let's call it, sufficient technological and administrative tools to keep data safe or entirely safe, because they may consider economic factors when they define and implement security mechanisms. And this is a risk, and this is a very clear risk to fundamental rights, because data are not entirely safe while being processed and retained by carriers.
Yes, thank you very much. And this is a kind of idea that you have, that data has only one way, just goes. It's quite complicated to have in and come back. But thank you very much. And then you have a kind of tricky question right now for Dr. Mirko. Fighting international terrorism, strengthening internal security, and better migration management. How to combine all these objectives without violating fundamental rights?
Really tricky question. I do think it is the question. It is the question to be answered in these years. And I really think it is the issue of my research activities as well. So I still need to find an answer to this question. Well, I think the first step is to understand how to strike a balance, as to strike a balance between security on the one end and the fundamental rights on the other end. I think this is the main issue. It is the main issue. So we need to understand what security is. We need to agree on the concept of security. Security is not an static concept. Security is not an immutable concept. Security mutates. The concept of security mutates according to the surrounding society, according to the surrounding environment, and security policies will follow as well. The current trend towards digitalization of migration management, datafication of borders management is a prime example of the securitization approach towards migration issues. So it's part of, we can say, a biopolitical approach towards migration flows. More data we have, more we know about migration issues, about migration flows, more we are able to manage, to govern, more we are able to implement a better governance of migratory flows. However, fundamental rights protection standard we mentioned before, the so-called necessity test of the European Court of Human Rights, according to which any interference with the fundamental rights framework should be provided by law, should be considered necessary, should be considered proportionate to serve any legitimate aims in a democratic society, suggests an approach, a governance approach focused on the specific case, focused on the specific cases. So I strongly suggest a periodical assessment of security policies, a periodical assessment in order to understand if security policies are still necessary, functioning working tools in order to manage, in order to deflect security threats. I would like also to stress the necessity to be careful about unforeseeable security threats, unspecified security threats, for example, terrorism, but also the COVID-19 pandemic. According to the most relevant case law of the European Court of Justice, I could remember the so-called Quadrature du Net case. Any limitation to the fundamental rights framework should be limited in time and place in order to prevent a specific, in order to prevent a foreseeable, in order to prevent a limit security threats. So I would like to stress how easy is to give away our security, how easy is to give away our liberties, our freedoms, but it's a more complex task to bring them back.
Right. Thank you very much. Thank you. And right now, I would like just to pass to our members. And actually, there is one member, Victoria Costa, who sent a question to Professor Alexander, which is, the article incorporates the social construction of an EU interest in counterterrorism, US influence and internal struggles in the cases of PNR and SWIFT. States that one of the ways that EU member states decided to develop their cooperation in counterterrorism was by adopting programmatic documents such as anti-terrorism roadmap, EU plan of action on combating terrorism, EU counterterrorism strategy, and the revised strategy on terrorism financing. The EU counterterrorism strategy states that terrorist behavior needs to be disrupted by limiting the activities of those playing a role in radicalization, preventing access to terrorist training, establishing a strong legal framework to prevent incitement and recruitment, and examining ways to impede terrorist recruitment through the internet. How do you think the EU plans to action-wise, bring about these ideas through a working mechanism? Also, do you think there should be a stricter assessment of the EU nationals' activities in comparison to the tracking of migrants' activities through the EU databases?
Sure. So, of course, those documents that you mentioned are very well known. Of course, you talked about the EU counterterrorism strategy. Responses after 9/11, of course, led to something of overload. There were a huge number of responses all of a sudden that were kind of thrust onto the EU agenda, and many states didn't end up actually implementing them. It's interesting, the EU counterterrorism strategy, I was told years ago, is really just the UK's with a few different words, the initial one, because of course it was agreed also under the UK's presidency in the second half of 2005. Now, moving on to what the EU actually does in relation to counter-radicalization, of course, there have been a number, and you know, dealing with online activities, there have been, of course, a number of initiatives such as the creation of a radicalization awareness network. We've talked about the data retention directive. There's actually a debate in the literature about whether, you know, to what extent actually online activities play a role in radicalization, even, and radicalization has of course been critiqued as you know, how do we actually do this? How do we actually deal with this? This is also an issue, of course, that member states deal with themselves, and a number of different member states have a number of different projects in relation to radicalization. When it was one, of course, the UK went further. Most prevents is infamous, and also its intentions to intervene and monitor people's internet activity have become somewhat infamous, I think, especially after the Snowden revelations. On to the second part of the question, where you're asking about, you know, monitoring the activities of EU citizens as well. Of course, we've already talked about the range of different measures that have been taken. We've talked about Schengen, we've talked about PNR. I also heard a while ago about the possibility of the extension of, basically monitoring people's ferry and train journeys as well. There seemed to be this concern in the EU about monitoring these sorts of activities and this sort of travel too. I think an issue we haven't mentioned, or a couple of issues we haven't mentioned, are those. We've talked about fundamental rights. We've talked about issues of kind of data leakage, these sorts of problems as well. But we haven't talked about efficacy. You know, do these measures actually work? And this has been a constant battle for me. I've been trying to find out for years, you know, what does the gathering of these data actually do? What does it actually achieve? I've seen a few examples here and there, but it's been very, very difficult to obtain information about whether these actually work. Also, there's issues of data overload. Is this so much data that, you know, can we actually find anything worthwhile? Is it like a needle in a haystack? These are the sorts of issues that I've kind of been interested in for quite a while, but I found the answers I've generally found have been pretty unsatisfactory. But what I will finish with is simply to say that although I have concerns and these sorts of concerns here, I'm not entirely sure what the alternatives are or what alternatives have actually been considered. But I'm pretty skeptical of these sorts of measures and have been for a while.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I think also Professor Ricardo would like to comment.
If I may, I'm sorry, but actually, as I worked on this, on PNR in terms of efficacy, actually, this is one of the drivers of my thesis, but I actually, unfortunately, I had to park it for later studies, for later developments. But I was so sad when that happened, when my supervisor says, you know, we can put that in the conclusions and maybe eventually for the future lives. Oh no, that's the funniest part. But what I found out, and I can share this with you now, is that in December 2019, the civil rights organization Society for Civil Rights, the Gesellschaft für Freirechte, and Epicenter Works, I'm not gonna, okay, that's two, Plattform Grundesrecht Politik, they held a presentation. This presentation was part of a campaign called No PNR, Let's Kill the Next Data Retention Law. So like quite blunt, you know, in a sense. But one of the most striking matters that they talked about was the effectiveness or efficacy rates of EU PNR systems in achieving their purposes and in actually successfully or not targeting suspicious passengers. And listen to this. According to the presenters, and I'm quoting from my own PhD thesis, because this is actually has been, you know, flying under the radar, but this is actually the key issue or one of the key issues of PNR. Does it work? And according to them, they said that from the transposition of the PNR directive in 2018 until mid-August 2019, so more or less, you know, a year, the PIU operating in Germany checked 31,617,068 PNR receipts. So 31 million. There were 237,643 positive matches, like hits, like Dr. Forti was talking about, from which 910 were relevant for criminal investigations. The numbers of false positives and true hits are unknown, but 910 hits correspond to about 0.4% of positive matches and only 0.003% of all PNR receipts verified. So 57 people were consequently detained or arrested, which corresponds roughly to 0.0002% of screened passengers. It's not known for what crimes they were targeted. And the numbers of Austria, just these two examples, Austria and Germany, the numbers of Austria are also striking. Until 30 September 2019, roughly more than 1 year of the PNR directive being implemented in the country, 23,877,277 PNR receipts of about 11,900,000 travelers were verified. There were only 591 positive matches from which only 280 were deemed relevant for law enforcement operations. The numbers of false positives through hits, arrests, or detentions were not disclosed, but 280 hits correspond to about 0.15% of positive matches and 0.001% of all the checked receipts. So in the meanwhile, the Austrian PIU costs about 1,840,570 euros per year to maintain. So I think what we see here is that the gap between processed PNR receipts and useful hits is enormous. And this was known, and the problem is this was known by EU institutions before the approval of the PNR directive. When the court was talking about the invalidation or not invalidation of the PNR agreement with Canada, they knew that the processing of PNR data enabled the arrest of 178 people from 28 million travelers who flew between the European Union and Canada in the period ranging from April 2014 and March 2015. And it's interesting, it continues. PNR data had also led to drug seizures in 71 cases and seizure of child pornography in 2 cases. The data also made it possible to initiate or further pursue investigations in relation to terrorism in 169 cases. Even if we consider all these cases separately and discarding false positives, it means that the EU knew that out of 28 million people who had their personal data collected and screened and held for God knows how long, only 420 cases represented positive matches. 420 cases correspond to about 0.0015% of the receipts verified. And this is striking. The EU knew how ineffective the system is. Plus, PNR does not work alone. There are other systems, as Dr. Forti talked about, as Professor McKenzie mentioned, there are many other systems applying to the same people at the same, more or less the same time, who could actually, and I truly believe this, could actually overcome all the investigatory purposes that the EU claims to pursue with this kind of legislation. And actually, coming back to the question made to Dr. Forti, you know, the first review of the PNR directive 1 year after it was transposed was a sham. You know, the representatives of the EU Commission just said, well, now we don't have time to actually assess how effective and how proportionate it is. We are still implementing and we're still in the course of, you know, sanctioning those member states who had not implemented it, who have not implemented it as we wanted. So, and it's okay, we'll see it in the future. This is not reasonable. This is not review. This is a sham. This cannot happen. Good, strong reviews, especially honest reviews of such security policies need to be implemented in the EU. And if it's not done in the EU, I'm sorry, but it's not done anywhere else. And because we are still a bastion of fundamental rights. And if we leave this aside, if we leave this question, this goal aside, then what else? Sorry, again.
No, I have to say, but this is my own opinion. I do agree with you. Actually, if you just have in mind the time of the negotiations from 2002 until 2016, and then you have the attacks in Belgium, in Brussels, and the attacks at the airport, and then everybody linked with the attacks in US. So you just had a decision in a rush and you approved the directive. So it was everything in a rush. So of course, you have some questions regarding the if it's proportionate, if it's necessary, and how we can achieve this efficacy regarding the data that every time they are collecting. And actually, regarding these different databases that you have now, for example, we have these other databases that they are still in under discussions, the TCN eCRIS, it's a kind of European criminal record database that It's supposed to be for third country nationals. However, the idea is that they can also collect EU data, so EU citizens' data, if that person has a double, three nationalities. If one of the nationalities it's out, it's from a non-EU country. So then you started to ask ourselves, so why do you need all those data? This is really necessary, proportionate, and all those things. So thank you very much for your comment. So now I pass to Priscilla, because I think she also has a question here.
Yeah, I would like to make a question to Professor Ricardo. In your PhD thesis, you mentioned that profiling seems inherent to the PNR system, and this is one of the most preoccupying features, since passengers may be classified in a way that human operators do not entirely understand, but based on which they must take relevant decisions. Interference with fundamental rights does not appear to be justified and goes beyond what is necessary to achieve the objectives of the PNR. Could you briefly explain this disproportion? And despite being disproportionate and interfering with the fundamental rights of air passengers, do you consider that profiling is already a point of no return in EU migration policy?
Well, basically, that's a question of my thesis. So if you have time, I will read my thesis. Chapter one. No, I'm joking. But actually, this is a quick question of the last chapter of my thesis. And, you know, in very simple terms, profiling is the process of classifying and treating people according to predetermined criteria. It is more or less the consensual basis that we can work on, so people understand what profiling is. And while the PNR directive actually avoids using the term profiling, this does not prevent profiling from actually taking place during the processing of data. And actually, every author mentions, or almost every author mentions profiling. The only person who has actually bluntly said that profiling does not occur in PNR has been the proponent of the PNR directive at the EU, at the EP Parliament, at the EP. the MEP Kirkhope. Who said profiling does not occur. I never looked at him like, no, actually profiling is the basis of PNR. So, okay, fine. And you know, despite all negotiations, as Emmeline said, we see that PNR is a product of political stress, of political, we need to show something. We need to demonstrate that we're doing something. We need to look busy. Jesus is coming, you know, look busy. And this is what happened with PNR, and it trumped a series of fundamental rights. But the fact is, profiling is inherent in the system because it aims to sort through people to identify, and I'm quoting from Article 6.2a, those who require further examination by the competent authorities. End of quote. So it's clear that profiling happens. The problem is that these trumps, how it does profiling trumps a lot of fundamental rights along the way. I'm not going to talk about all the problems. The length of the data retention period, Dr. Forti has mentioned it, it's 5 years, but it's 5 years. That's what it says on the directive. But if you think about it, if you travel one more time during those 5 years, then 5 years begin anew. So it's a sort of loop that never ends. Well, and even when you're dead and hopefully not flying, your data will still be there, will still be, or at least will be, it will be possible for someone somewhere, and you probably will never know, especially because you're dead, but your family will not know who is actually looking at your data and for what reasons you're using it. This is a really far-fetched system. How data are exposed in the beginning as well. One of the key problems that I think is what Dr. Forti talked about before is that it contains sensitive elements. You know, the data that's conveyed contains sensitive elements like health information. And these are generally prohibited in light of the Charter of Fundamental Rights of the EU. In fact, interestingly, the court in the case that Dr. Forti mentioned, like Quadratura du Net, the court drew a red line in saying that the fact that data can be used for establishing profiles, one, and two, that sensitive material can be collected, can suffice or may suffice to claim that certain data systems, like that created by the PNR directive, allow for very precise conclusions to be drawn concerning the private lives of the persons whose data have been retained. This is a quote from the court. And so this is opening the door for suspicion that that system in concrete is, you know, disrespects in a way, or it can be put under the spotlight. On the other hand, there is no limitation on the categories of data to be retained or on the persons affected by the PNR system. The goal was, and this is very clear by the EP discussions, the goal was to collect, by those advocating for the PNR system, the goal was to collect, process, use, and catalog every single piece of data from every single passenger. And this was bluntly put at the EP. And despite the concerns that it obviously raises for every single person, you know, where is the line? Where is the criterion of proportionality? And in fact, if there are no clear alternatives to such blanket data collection and retention, then perhaps we should question the system itself. The entire system is de jure disproportionate and should be put into question. And let's hope that we have a decision of the court this year. We cannot prolong this anymore. Regarding the second question, I did not go into a lot of detail of what profiling is and whether profiling is a point of no return in the EU migration policy. But I have to, you know, be a, you know, devil's advocate for a second here. Profiling can be negative, but it can also be positive. You know, profiling from a positive perspective of positive discrimination, also called differentiation, is essential to, you know, to go through passengers and make people safe and make, in a sense, and all of us safe, or at least safer in the end of the day. So profiling is necessary to a degree, to a certain extent. It can be developed and rooted in our migration policies and in our transit regulations. I'm not sure if this happens, you know, across the board, and if this is the foundation of our EU migration policy at large, but, you know, it is to a certain extent a necessary evil to avoid thornier issues or even terrible consequences. Profiling does not have to be a terrible thing to avoid at all costs. And it is, of course, more and more part of our lives. We actually allow entities to profile us, starting with Instagram and ending up when we fly to, you know, a third country or even an EU member state. But what's important, I think, and I'll conclude here, in security checks and in the PNR system as a whole, is that this differentiation is regulated and does not become negative discrimination. It's limited, so it does not escalate, it does not evolve, and that are clear lines that make these systems not become based on biased or irrelevant traces, but remain dependent on concrete and objective risk factors. And there are many authors calling, you know, raising this alarm, and I think we should pay attention to them and should pay attention eventually to what the court will tell us of the PNR system in the future.
Thank you so much.
I would like to make a question to Professor Mirko. So, Professor Mirko, what are the consequences of failed identification procedures in managing migration flows? Is the risk of refoulement directly related to the topic I'm asking about? Thank you.
Thank you for your question. Very interesting, very relevant. Well, identification procedures at the frontiers, at the borders, create different possibilities to access fundamental rights, different possibilities accordingly with variables, accordingly with elements like race, ethnicity, gender, social-cultural background, nationality, and so on and so forth. And this is particularly true when it comes to data-driven identification procedures. Data-driven identification procedures when and where technologies, emerging technologies, act as a mediating agent between people and their fundamental rights. Failures in identification procedures could lead to discriminatory outcomes, that could exacerbate the existing vulnerabilities of people like migrants, refugees, and asylum seekers, and that could exploit social divisions between the ones inside the borders, for example, European citizens, and the one outside the borders, for example, their country nationals. And also in this case, this is particularly true for data-driven identification procedures. When before deploying technological devices at the frontiers for identification purposes, we should remember, we should be careful about related risks, related technological risks, for example, algorithmic biases, the inherent opacity of AI algorithms, base rate errors, technical failures, and so on and so forth. And we must remember how algorithms works on statistical ground, work on statistical basis. So data not fitting the statistical majority, not fitting statistical predominant groups will alert the algorithm. So people belonging to minority group will therefore alert, the algorithms with the related consequences that could hinder the enjoyment, that could hinder the access to fundamental rights. I would like to also to stress, psychological consequences. Algorithms, technology work accordingly with the surrounding society, accordingly with the surrounding circumstances. We must not believe to an assumption of technological neutrality. Data collection, data elaboration has a political import, has political consequences. So people will perceive themselves in a specific way. If the algorithm will be alert by such data, people may perceive themselves as wrong, in some ways. And I would like also to stress out that, as we said before, technology is not neutral, and technology will sustain specific values in spite of other values. So maybe it could be a risk, it could push forward European values in spite of other values. It could be a consequence that we must be aware of. As far as the reforming principle is concerned, focusing on your question, I think that failures in the identification procedure will lead to a lack of acknowledgement of the inherent vulnerabilities of people involved, a misunderstanding of such vulnerabilities that could have as a consequence the involvement of people in pushbacks that could endanger their lives, pushbacks that could endanger their physical integrity, that could in turn endanger their mental integrity as well.
Thank you very much. It was great. Thank you. And right now, before closing this wonderful podcast, I'd like to ask our guests if you'd like to share with our audience any project or research you are involved in or developing, which will certainly be of interest to all of us to follow. So I would like to start with Professor Alexander.
I'm working on a few things right now, actually. Number one, about Russia-Ukraine, there's been a concern for a while that they're actually, that we've talked about an awful lot about Islamic State foreign fighters. There's actually been a concern that they're actually far-right foreign fighters who, and far-left foreign fighters who participated in the conflicts in the Donbass after 2014. So we've been working on that sort of area also, because people have ignored the non-Islamic State foreign fighters, interestingly. The history of the UK's role in counterterrorism as well in the EU, which I think has actually been underdeveloped in the literature. We focused on the institutions. We haven't focused so much on the role of the member states, which is odd if you look at it that way. Thirdly, the future development of the UK-EU security relationship, which, of course, there's an awful lot to deal with there. And I'll finish there. Thank you. Thanks very much.
Thank you. So I would like to ask Professor Mirko.
Yep. Thank you for your question. Me and my colleagues here at Sant'Anna School of Advanced Studies are currently working on data governance of migration issues. So how these data are collected, how these data are processed, and how these data are used accordingly with specific purposes. We are planning to publish a special issue on this, a top tier academic journal on this issue, on this topic. And we are also planning to hold a conference about, I think, September, October. Obviously, all of you, all of our audience are invited to attend this conference. We are all waiting for you here in Pisa, here in Italy.
Thank you very much. As soon as you know, we'll be there, that's sure. Thank you. And Professor Ricardo.
I think Dr. Forte, is always good to come back to Italy. I took my PhD, I made my PhD at the UI, so it's always a good reason to go back. Well, actually, I'm going to be a disappointment. I'm working on human rights and fundamental rights or human rights at a business level. So we're now in the first stages of a research where we want to know how different countries across the world respect or not human rights at the workplace. And first to see what is out there and then to think about it. And then in the end, think how we can change, you know, legislation at home and eventually abroad. And I'm going to begin working for a research center at a Catholic university. So still waiting to begin some of the further research I'm going to do. One of the investigatory trends is global challenges to EU integration. So I think it will be fun to see. It will be a balance between Hungary, Poland, and whatever is out there, basically what's happening now. And so it's going to be fun. But for now, I'm going to look for Dr. Fortes and Professor McKenzie's work first and then get inspired to work. Thank you so much for everything. And has been an amazing opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And now we come to the end of our episode. Thanks again for the brilliant and insightful participation of our guests, Alexander, Mirko, and Ricardo. To our followers, thank you for listening and stay tuned for upcoming episodes. Following us on the social media and on the Nova Refugee Clinic website. Thank you and bye.